Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
All right, welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. We're going to have a quick intro. We're going to talk a little bit about Alex's SC. We're going to have an interview with Nate. We'll have a tip of the week and then finally some closing comments.
It's Valentine's Day, John. What are we doing talking to each other?
We all know we're secret lovers.
You just ruined the secret. Now I'm not interested in you.
And my wife's in the room too, and she's like, whatever. It's a special episode, not just because it's Valentine's Day today, but because it is Nate's French 10 years at FFG. That's big.
It's big. And the meat of the episode, as we mentioned in the description, is a retrospective with Nate where he's going to walk us through sort of the last 10 years and how that culminated in the only game that matters. I'm guessing that we should condense everything else because people will be coming here for the Nate and not for the us.
Yep. Speaking of store championships, there were a couple more this week. I know that the big Boston SC happened and that DC Dennis took it down, I think, for the second year in a row.
Yeah, there have been a couple that have already reported, and I'm sure there'll be more coming through. But I think the real narrative of this weekend is a rise of Greyjoy on the whole. It happened at our store championship. There was a very strong Greyjoy that finished top of Swiss. It happened at the one in Budapest where I think they had two Greyjoys, a Fealty and a No Agenda, finished top four, and one of those went on to win it. And I really think that this is on the back of the new Longship.
I think so, too. It's a fantastic card, and it's sad that all these people are playing it, because next weekend is my store championships. You know what I was going to take?
The Longship.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm still probably stuck with that, because I don't get a lot of time to play, and I haven't built any other deck.
I think that it's a really interesting card to drive part of the meta, because I think what it does is it puts a lot more pressure on Lannister than it does on, say, Barra or Targ. It's very hard to use the Hound as a counter to Unopposed. It's very hard to use him if you put him in that challenge and lose that, and the rating Longship targets him.
Yeah.
Or you can finally push that Put to the Sword through to kill that Tywin, which is a very important part of the play that you need to do against Lannister. So mm-hmm. I think that Barra can still make sure that it's not losing challenges by five or more with some aggressive Kneel, and you can use some of Targ's tricks as well to make sure you're not losing the wrong challenges. But in other decks, I think you need to start pushing your initiative a little bit higher or running more attachments to protect you from that Longship, because I think it will be a big force in the meta until the next chapter back.
I don't know if running more attachments protects you in a Greyjoy meta, because they tend to run, you know, one or two Rattleshirt Raiders, especially if it's a No Agenda or Fealty deck, because they need those extra characters. And on top of that, they have We Do Not Sow.
Yeah, you sort of have to be careful not to lose those unopposed challenges, and that's what the attachments are trying to help you do. But you're right. It certainly isn't an obvious answer, but it does buy you some safety. I really like the card, though. I think the card has those balanced drawbacks of going first and picking a character without attachments that the meta can adjust accordingly.
Oh, easily, yeah. And it came in the same pack as a plot designed to hurt it, right?
It did indeed. And it may be, given the percentage of locations I was seeing in those Greyjoy decks, it may be that some decks will start running that. I don't think they will quite yet, but I think it's something that they'll look at. Speaking, I guess I mentioned the Until the Next Chapter Pack. The Next Chapter Pack has a street date in Canada. It is the 25th of February, so I would guess that is the 25th or the 24th of February in the U.S., and I'm really excited about this chapter pack. It's got the new agenda. It's got that Meereen heat. Yeah. It's going to be – I think this is the final pieces that Tyrell needed to see a lot more play as the main faction, and I'm really, really pumped to see that as well.
That agenda is great out of Tyrell, and I think the Meereen heat is going to be a phenomenal card for those Knights decks.
Other sort of tournament-related news, I do want to mention that the Tabletop Tourney Grounds – division qualifier deadline for applications. So this is Chris Kaiser's regional-like structure that's happening later in the year. If your local store was going to apply, the deadline for that is the 25th of February. In tournament software, there is a new piece of community tournament software that also gathers stats. This is called the Jousting Pavilion. It's worth checking out. It looks very, very pretty. If we can get a chance to integrate that in the annals as well, that would be kind of neat. So we're gonna work with that a little bit so that it might also be able to import data directly into the annals. We haven't started that.
Did you check out the other one?
What was the other one?
There was a tournament software that came out earlier that was HTML5, and you could do it from your cell phone and everything. agotgame.com.
Yeah, I think the more of these that we can integrate so that their whatever they export goes directly into the annals, the easier the process of data collection will be. And it's just a question of setting up the right APIs, basically, which is beyond my area of expertise. But hopefully I can pester James about this, who has been essential to every step of the way for fixing the annals and the RSS feed for this cast and has been
kind of awesome.
Yes. Well, more than kind of awesome. Definitely awesome.
Speaking about the cast, though, we have a big thing coming up.
No, we don't tell people about that.
We don't tell them that it's going to be our 100th episode.
Our centennial?
I think we have to do something for that, like a giveaway or something.
We definitely have to do something, but we probably have to figure out what we're doing before we talk about doing it.
It's true.
But stay tuned, listeners.
Yes,
exactly. We also have a couple other news about tournaments. There's official news about UK Nationals now. So this is worth checking out. I know that last year it was very last minute and there was a lot of confusion as to how it was being organized and what the prizes were. So this year their distributor has well in advance announced the UK Nationals for all of the LCGs. So even if you don't like the date, at least you know it well in advance. It is at the beginning of August, I think second week of August potentially, or the first weekend of August. So I'll have a link to that in the cast description as well.
Yeah, there was a big another big announcement, right? There was a, I was going to say, Nationals at the same time as Fleabottom Fracas.
So that is the UK Nationals is at the same time as Fleabottom Fracas. Yeah. And the other thing which has been in the works for a little while is the Tournoi de la Main, which is the Road to Stalag Tour in France, which is the 16th and 17th of April, is at the same time as the Saragossa tournament, which is not a Road to Stalag tournament, but is a very, very big tournament in Spain, the 16th and 17th of April. So those are two conflicting events in the European sort of grand scheme of things, as well as Fleabottom Fracas and the UK Nationals. To some extent, that's inevitable as the game gets bigger. So long as Road to Stalag events aren't conflicting with other Road to Stalag events, I think we're probably okay. But it would be nice for those distributors and the local community to really interact to get that a little better distributed so they don't cannibalize. Obviously, I think the number of players that we have for these sorts of events, I mean, Batalla, which is in March, Batalla por el Muro, has over 150 registrants already. And
poof, that's amazing.
So maybe they can afford to leech a little bit from one another while we're stuck with our 16-person SCs.
But either way, that was a lot of news.
That was a lot of news. There is one final piece of news that we've been asked to promote, and this is Thrones Weekend at Ryan's, also Thrones War.
Yes, because you can actually go and kind of bet on which team you think is going to do the best. They got a couple different categories, and the people that score the most points win some alternate house cards that look like Disney princesses.
Just fitting for California. This is tournament we've talked about in the past. We had Ryan on last year to talk about the first edition version. There are 8 team captains, which are called kings, or it seemed pretty cute, prince if they're Martell or so on. But they get together and then they bid on factions with a starting pool of money, and then they bid on players that will join their team, and they're all teams of 4, and they will never play another player from their own team. So you see whether, you know, Martell as a faction, having maybe spent a little bit less on the faction and more on players, can do better in this tournament. So yeah, there's definitely a reason to check out the Google form where you can pick your winners, your losers, the teams that you think will do best, and then follow it because they will be live streaming that. It will be available on Twitch. So you can get invested in this tournament, invested in your favorite faction or your favorite players, your favorite team, and see who comes out on top this coming weekend.
Pretty fun.
I do one last thing.
One last piece of news?
Last piece of news. And this is kind of the Trump moment of the cast. By even acknowledging this, I'm giving it more publicity, and I feel like that's stupid. But there was a new podcast called Brotherhood Without Manners.
Mm-hmm.
And clever name, clever logo. But within the first 30 seconds, they basically proceeded to antagonize a good portion of the community. And
explicit.
Doesn't quite cover it. And this feels like the kind of content that, if it were satirical or actually funny, would be great to have. You know, someone mocking how seriously we take ourselves is great. But here it just appears to be capitalizing on what they think might be a wedge in the community. And I really hope that the niche that they're aiming for doesn't exist.
Angry new players? The angry new player niche.
Yeah, or at least is a very small niche.
That's it. So, Alex, you played in an SC in your own hometown.
I did. Last year, when we had a SC in Quebec City, I was the only person attending from locally, and a group from Montreal had driven down, and we had five people, and we did a round robin and then a draft, and, you know, had fun, but I was certainly hoping for more this year, and boy, did I get it. You know, even though the local community is only about, you know, it was only three players 3 weeks ago, and it's now about six or seven, but we got 12 people from outside the city, and four out of our five regulars, one who was sick. So we got 16 people, which is really nice because it's one of those zones where you don't have to break
perfect
the FFG
numbers, okay.
Rules. You actually get to do four rounds of Swiss in a top four. But I really, really want to thank all these people who drove 2.5 hours to come.
Where'd they come from?
From Montreal.
So was it 12 people from Montreal?
From Granby. Basically, many from Montreal area except from a couple from Chicoutimi. So I first of all would refute the notion that people won't travel for store championships, if that's the idea behind these new rules. It was also a lot of people's first event, so I had a prize to anyone for whom it was their first SC, or and, you know, the lowest placing new person got to pick from a pool of prizes, and I worked my way up, and I think there were seven that took prizes for that. I mean, they played in game night kits in Montreal or whatever, but this was their first store championship, their first experience with it. I got to break out the Warhammer, all the play mats to decorate the place a little bit, which was a lot of fun as well.
That's cool.
And I played a deck I really enjoyed. I played Stark Fealty, which was mostly because I still hadn't had a chance to test some of the things I wanted to do with Rose. Most of what this deck does, I think it'll do slightly better with Rose. I think because I mentioned last week that Stark was doing better than expected in the Annals, and so I took another look at it and decided, what can I do that isn't just kill? Because we've seen the Stark kill, and we've seen the Stark intrigue-based kill that took second at Stalik. And I wanted a deck that built on Threat of Activation, that said, Kennel Masters will make you always fear the put to the sword if I have two extra gold. You know, any trigger you want to play, Caitlyn can potentially block, and I can jump her into challenges with Lady, or, you know, I can give her that military icon with Sirio, so that I have so much threat of activation that my opponents tend to make mistakes, and then if I'm well-equipped to exploit them. And I like putting opponents in situations of pressure, because you can also play the opponent at that point and force them to overcommit on challenges just because you had that for the North last time and your finger and a card in your hand. And I got a chance to do a fair bit of that. So I wouldn't say the deck is particularly consistent or remarkably solid, but I would say that Caitlyn is just an absolutely stellar character, and Ice, if you add in Building Orders, is just an amazing card as well. And I think Building Orders may be the most underrated plot in the game for a deck that can really dig out that attachment or needs to smoothen out its location base. I really like Building Orders in that deck.
I think in that deck it's perfect because, like you said, Ice is so high impact. It's probably...
But I mean, sometimes I need to dig for the intrigue icon, and sometimes I need to dig for the resources. And I only had 11 non-Stark cards in the deck, so Gates of Winterfell was also a reasonably good draw. And I was running Shadow Black Lane, which tended to replace itself reasonably well. Again, with that threat of activation, people are afraid of losing intrigue. They're afraid of losing military. And then I hit them with the claim 3 power, which is what really mattered, you know. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And I think that adding in Marjorie into the mix and some other things might make that deck better. But losing some of the draw that it had might make it worse. So I'd still have to play with that concept a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, Marjorie's always pretty solid card in general, and I bet a single Randall or two wouldn't hurt the deck either.
But so that was fun. But also, in addition to that, it was a very fun tournament. It played out well. We finished pretty close to on time. The store that we're in is fantastic. People bought product at the store. The store threw all the extra money from the registrations into gift certificates, which I was able to give to people who didn't make the cut, and add into that prize pool for new players. We had a prize for when we had 10 people show up for the tournament. I gave out that prize to encourage people to show up on time. So there were a lot of little things that I did that I was very, very happy with the end result of. And, I mean, our top four was a Quebec player versus a Quebec player, myself versus Francis Coty, and a Montreal player versus a Montreal player. So it was going to be the Quebec Championship and the Montreal Championship, and then we faced off. So I lost in the finals, but that also added a little bit of an element of narrative and story to the tournament.
And Montreal took it home.
Montreal took it away from us. They took it away game. But yeah,
so
but
sad.
Then afterwards we went out to a pub and had a meal, and there was seven of us there just to have some beers and chat about the tournament, and chat about the way Thrones is going, you know, family, traveling, all that other stuff. So there was a socializing aspect at the end of a store championship. So,
Thrones is going good.
Yeah. It was just an amazing tournament experience, and I was really glad to be able to host it. So. Yeah. So, for many of our listeners, this will be a first. They may not know who this is, but they will shortly. We are joined by an illustrious guest, a guest whose name is probably synonymous with Thrones, probably more so than anyone else, and maybe synonymous with LCGs in general. We have Nate French from Fantasy Flight Games.
Hi, everyone.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your role at Fantasy Flight, something more specific than synonymous with LCGs?
Well, that's a pretty good synopsis of it. My title is Senior LCG Designer. I'm in some ways the creative leader of the LCG team, and our manager, Chris Gerber, is kind of the formal leader. He handles a lot of the scheduling and budgets and kind of production-oriented stuff, and I kind of do a lot of creative coaching and mentoring and review of everyone's work, and I also work on my own projects. Most of my projects over the years have kind of been core sets and early cycles in the LCGs, and then I work with a new designer, not necessarily new to the company, but a new person for the line to kind of groom them in and make sure that we're handing off the games to a competent party who has a passion for the game and can do a good job in creating new sets and cards for that game.
So you said over the years. Maybe we should center in on that. You've told me that there's something special about this year.
Yeah, February 13th is going to be my 10-year anniversary with Fantasy Flight.
Wow. And you started off as a player, right, of the LCGs?
Yes, I started off as a player of Game of Thrones back in 2002 when the game was actually a CCG back then, and read Song of Ice and Fire in college, really loved the books, kind of came across the game by chance in a game store, picked up starter decks, started playing and collecting it, went out to a couple of tournaments, and I guess I kind of got on the company's radar at the first Gen Con. I was runner-up to Casey Galvin, and after that tournament, started talking to Eric Lang a little. He got me into playtesting. A couple years later, they hired Casey as a developer. That didn't work out. He had to leave for personal reasons, but I had stayed working with him as a playtester, and he kind of told me, like, yeah, you should send in a resume. So that was early 2006. Didn't really feel I had anything to lose by sending in a resume, so I did so, and they brought me up for an interview, and everything went well, and 10 years later, I'm still here, so.
And you still play the games, too, right?
Yes, I still play most of our LCGs. There's so many of them that
most
it is
of,
a little,
yeah, that's a good
it is a little hard to keep up on everything, but
you play Game of Thrones, that's what really matters, right?
Yeah, I play Game of Thrones.
So how much does that personal play experience influence your design process, or does it at all?
I'd say it's probably more the reverse, that the design has influenced my personal play more, in that I used to be what most people would call a very competitive player. Like, I played to win, to find the best decks, and if I wasn't winning, I really wasn't enjoying the game. Once I started working as a designer, my whole approach to the game changed. I do kind of feel like to be really good at one of these games, you have to not seek out enjoying yourself playing it. Like, you almost have to play in a way that finds a way to avoid the common things that people are doing and kind of find a different approach to the game. And thinking about it as a designer, you're looking more for interesting interactions and things that are true to the source material. And we call it, around the office, we call it Eric Lang disease, because Eric is very, he's kind of infamous as being very bad at his own games. And it kind of happens to everyone. Once they start working on a game, their ability to play it at a high level slips a bit. So I think that there's something about the approach of when you're trying to make a game fun and enjoyable to people, that competitive attitude you need to bring to the table kind of goes away or dissipates or lessens a bit. So I think it was kind of the reverse effect, where designing changed the way I played.
I'm definitely going to call every time I lose just being subject to Eric Lang disease. This sounds like a great excuse.
You're just having fun. But I guess that's kind of interesting, because I guess at some point it led you to The Lord of the Rings, which is a non-competitive game, right? Which is all about the fun.
Yeah, that's true, although it was actually, in a way, it was a behavior of competitive players that led to the initial inspiration for that game. For those who don't know, Lord of the Rings was the first kind of solo slash cooperative collectible slash living card game. And basically where the idea came from was, I was at Gen Con one year and I just noticed, it wasn't the first time I had noticed it, but it was the first time I noticed it in a way that inspired me with the idea for a game, but a behavior that players call goldfishing, where it's like they'd take the deck they're thinking of playing and they'd shuffle it up and deal out like a starting hand and maybe play through the first setup phase and their first draw and just kind of see what they get on the board. And players, to kind of get a feel for how a deck was going to perform, would do this over and over just when they didn't have an opponent to practice with. And it was watching that I kind of thought, like, if there's people, they can pass their time doing that. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a game that someone could play without an opponent? And that was kind of where the genesis of that game came from.
We call that doing a Corey.
You call that doing a Corey? Well,
because he just plays himself over and over again.
That's because he's the only player of his caliber. I mean,
that might be true.
that might be.
Yeah, I've heard stories of Greg Atkinson driving from Missouri to tournaments in Minnesota by himself, but also while he was driving, playing practice games on the passenger seat. So that might be a little dangerous, but
yeah, we don't recommend that to any of our listeners.
That's right. I certainly want to touch on Lord of the Rings again later, but I sort of wonder, because you came into the game while it was still a CCG, and even from a design standpoint as well, you were first tapped while it was still a CCG.
Yep. When I joined the company in 2006, there was no such thing as an LCG. Yeah. Game of Thrones CCG was going into it. The end of the winter block was when I first came on, so we were on the second expansion, the third set overall for the winter block. Each block was base set followed by two expansions. And then that was the end of year four. Year five was Iron Throne. And so I worked on all three sets of Iron Throne in the CCG. And then we did Five Kings was the base set for year six. And Clash of Arms would have been, it was originally designed as a CCG expansion, but midway through that was kind of when, as a company, we were realizing that the CCG model wasn't the future of where we wanted to go as a company. And we had a bunch of brainstorm meetings and eventually came up with the ideas that formed the core of the LCG model, like a base core set followed by these fixed monthly expansion packs. The deluxe boxes were added a little bit after the fact, once we realized that we needed to get cards into the card pool a little bit faster. But it was kind of like those basic ideas were at the heart of, we're going to take this play experience of the CCG, but present it in a way that is much more accessible to most people out there and also more fair. Clash of Arms was kind of a challenge, because it had been designed as a CCG set, and then we had to deconstruct it, find the best parts of it, and transfer it into the first LCG cycle, which was the Clash of Arms cycle. And then shortly after that, the core set came out, and we eventually rotated the CCG products. That was a bit of a controversial move at the time, but in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. And then went forward with the Raven cycle and King's Landing and all of the Game of Thrones 1.0.
So you just touched on it a little bit, but I'm really curious as to what kind of changes that is when you say, we've designed this as a CCG set, we're going to this LCG model. Obviously, it's very early in the LCG model, I'm sure you learn things down the road, but what changes did you have to make to a CCG set to bring it into an LCG? How were those formats different from a design standpoint that you had to approach them differently?
So, yeah, there's a number of key differences. There's probably a lot more smaller ones. Some of the big ones, each cycle of LCG cards is considerably smaller than a CCG set. So a CCG set for a year was 240 cards in the base set, and then each expansion was probably about between 160 and 180 cards, if I remember correctly. It was so over the course of the year, you got 540 cards, whereas in a common year for the LCG, we'll get the two cycles, one pack every month, and maybe a deluxe box or two. So you're working with fewer cards overall. And the other thing with those cards is the rarity level. Rarity is a kind of a big thing when designing for CCGs, because you're dividing all your cards into common, uncommon, and rare. So thinking about basically its impact level, how many people are going to have access to the card. Like, not everybody buys enough packs to get a full playset. So like your commons and uncommons are going to be kind of the bread and butter cards. And then your rare cards you're trying to design cards that you want your upper level players to want to chase down. But also there's kind of a balancing act, because you don't just want it to be like whoever has the best rares is automatically going to win. So you're trying to navigate those type of issues. It wasn't really a concern in design for LCGs until recently, but draft is another big part of CCG design, because draft is a format that drives a lot of sales for CCGs. So, mm-hmm. And that also kind of is what you're thinking about when you're designing those common and uncommon cards, because even if they do get pushed out of decks for rare cards in the constructed environment, they're going to always be kind of what you're seeing in most draft games. I think the other big change to kind of it took a little while to wrap my head around was that the pace of change was both, it was slower over time, and you also missed out on these moments of real big sweeping changes to the meta. Like a new set launches and there's a couple of weeks where everybody's back to the drawing board and trying to resolve things, where that's CCG style. Like you release a set, then you go for a couple months with that same card pool, then the next set comes out. You have these kind of peaks of high intensity, everybody's building new decks, and then there's no product for a couple of months. Whereas the LCG, it's more steady. You get a new pack every month, but it's because it's more steady, it's also a little bit more controlled and not as roller coastery to a lot of people. It's like you get a pack and there might be a few cards that you get to update a deck, and then before you know it, the next pack's coming out, but people have assimilated the last one. So there it's more of a, I guess, just a linear rate of change.
Yeah, there's not as large a disruption. Is that taken into account into the LCG to make certain cards more disruptive, or was this part of the idea behind the restricted list in first edition to bring in this disruption?
There is something cool about lots of cards, right? It's like Christmas magic. It's like, yep, a box that you open it and it's like, oh, wow, there's a lot of new stuff here.
Yep. You do get that experience a little bit early on in an LCG, and it's kind of like as the card pool grows, each new pack has slightly less impact overall on what it brings to the table, just in terms of disrupting the game or making people feel new. But there are times where, like, with individual cards, we will kind of strategically place cards either at the start of a cycle or at the end of a cycle to kind of either give people like a shot in the arm right when the first pack comes out and give them kind of hints of new things to come. Or also sometimes we'll build towards a card that we know is going to be released towards the end of a cycle, where we're like teasing at something that's going to happen, and then a card might drop at the end that kind of brings it all together and closes something off. As far as the restricted list, it wasn't consciously made as a decision of like, we're going to use this restricted list to occasionally add this excitement into the cycle. In first edition, it kind of got to a point where that was kind of a peripheral effect doing with it, whereas like once, because the first Zed card pool got so big and we didn't have any type of rotation policy, the restricted list was a kind of a pseudo rotation where like we couldn't rotate out a complete block, but we could make sure that people were looking at new cards by restricting some of the ones that were showing up in every deck. So it did serve some of that purpose, which I think with the new rotation plans that were announced along with second edition, we now have a built-in mechanism for the card pool to turn itself over and hopefully give people a little bit more of that taste of having to rediscover things.
Before we continue, I wanted to say something about the current product that I like most that you created, which is the 2.0 set. Like, all right. I find that this is the strongest set to date from any of the LCGs I played. Super fantastic. But it's almost like, you know, you've been designing for 10 years now. You've come out with this just fantastic set. And I know it wasn't just you. I know there was a lot of people at Final Fantasy Games that worked with you on
Final Fantasy Games. I like this.
Okay.
You got FFG. A new license for
that. Yeah. Okay. Let's skip that. Let's go to FFG. But, there's a lot of people that work behind it as well. But do you think that your experiences as a designer over the last 10 years helped you create this great product? And, you know, kind of in the same vein, what were the lessons you had to learn as a designer to finally be able to produce just such a fantastic product?
I do feel that there were a lot of lessons learned over the years. Like, I believe that each of the games that I've worked on, and there's been big lessons learned and things that worked and also things that we tried something and maybe it wasn't the best idea at the time, but it was like, I think if you go through the different core sets we've done, each one has kind of grown from what came before. We go all the way back to the AGOT first edition core set. Like we put that out. It was almost like we were flying blind. Like we had this idea of what we wanted the LCG to be, but we were exploring and trying to figure out what we kind of knew what we wanted it to be, but we were trying to explore what it actually was. And it was in this position where it had kind of some board game elements. Like it came with a board and the plastic title pieces. And then it had some card game elements. It was also released as, when we released it, all of the CCG cards were still legal. So it was almost, in some ways, it was an expansion to the existing CCG pool. But at the same time, it was trying to be an entry point with starter decks. So it was somewhere between card game and board game, and it was somewhere between expansion product to an existing game and new starting point for a new game. So it was... I think that core set, it was trying to do too much, and I think that was a result of we had like this big vision of LCGs, and we were trying to cram it all in, and it was, in some ways, it may have been just overambitious of what we could do in that box. The second one I worked on was Call of Cthulhu, and this one was a little bit more focused in that it was launched as a fresh start for the card pool. So there was a Call of Cthulhu CCG, but we had ended it and we were launching the LCG as a fresh format. I think the big success of the Cthulhu core set was the faction mixing. We had all seven factions in that core set, and you could mix any one of those factions with any of the other factions. And it's actually, setting Lord of the Rings aside, which is kind of it's its own unique beast. That Cthulhu core set was, until we did Thrones 2.0, we never did another core set where that was possible, where you could take any of the factions in the box and mix them with any of the others. And it was probably the most popular thing about the way that core set was handled. But for different reasons, we weren't able to duplicate that until we got to Thrones 2.0. But it was always kind of in the back of my mind, like, this is a good thing to have a core set be able to do. And I'm glad I was able to bring that back with the Throne set. I think for the Cthulhu core set, one thing that didn't work out as well was the fact that the entire thing was Highlander. So you had a lot of variety, and that made people who were planning on buying three core sets happy. But at the same time, for anybody who wasn't sure they wanted to buy in with three, playing out of a single box, a Highlander experience is super high variance, and you don't really get any sense of craft. It's just every card we decided needed to be in that card pool was equally represented, and there wasn't any real feel that these decks were designed to a purpose. It was just whatever you drew, you played. So that out of a single box experience was missing in Cthulhu. Warhammer Invasion was the the next one. And I think the big lesson I learned with Invasion was don't do things differently just for the sake of being different. One thing that we tried with Invasion, and there wasn't really a good reason for it other than we don't want to repeat Thrones and Cthulhu, was we tried to implement timing system. In some ways, it was our first attempt to avoid having to do something with Moribund, but it really wasn't what the game was calling for. I do think that Invasion, probably the strongest thing about it was that it was the first game that was only designed as an LCG, and that allowed us to kind of plan the factions in a way that we had the core four that played really well out of the box, and we had the plans to add two more. So it allowed us to start thinking about how an LCG could start with just a core set as the cards, and then plan on how it's going to expand with monthly packs. Like, it didn't have the history of being compared to what it was like as a CCG. Lord of the Rings was we already talked a little bit about what it was. It was also, for me, it was the first game that I worked on basically as a lead designer on all of the other ones. I had been working with Eric Lang kind of as a developer and helping come up with card ideas and running playtesting and stuff, but he was kind of the driving creative force behind the original products. But Lord of the Rings was my original pitch, and I was leading the project from the start, and I think that was one really where it gave me a lot of confidence as a designer, and basically I was able to see that I was able to follow my own vision and take a project from that initial inspiration through to the end, and that was a real kind of, I think, just a big, big accomplishment for my career as far as getting to where I am now.
I have to interrupt just, I'm sure we'll go into the other games, but Lord of the Rings is such a favorite game of mine. It, first of all, when it was described to me, I was convinced it would never work. It is a game that has taught me a great deal about games in general, and because there are cards, and two examples. One is in the core set, there's the Anduin scenario that puts you on a river and then has enemies accumulating on the banks, mm-hmm. basically. And yep. Another being Caradhras, where you're going through the pass and the mountain is this enemy. This location is, it doesn't hate you, but it's just, mm-hmm. you know, a force of nature against you.
Yep.
And
yep.
those are two scenarios that really crafted a story and a narrative in a way that I didn't realize was possible without a dungeon mm-hmm. master or anything like that. There's storytelling built into that game to a degree that I didn't think was possible.
I noticed that even in the scenario we played, Alex, I had never played Lord of the Rings, and Alex had convinced me to actually show up at one of the Gen Con specialized scenarios, and I had a great time. And part of it was there was this cool story, and actually we didn't get to finish, but I harassed Alex, and we ended up putting it out in the airport so that we could play through it again.
So yeah, definitely the narrative aspect was kind of one of the driving forces there. One of the sources of inspiration that there's nothing direct, but it was I remember the feel of doing this that I was trying to capture in, I guess, card game form. When I was younger, I read a lot of these fantasy game books, which are basically choose your own adventure books where you also have a character sheet who has stats and hit
points. And you cheat, right?
You could cheat if you wanted to, but yeah, it's like if you die, you kind of could go back to where you made a bad choice and go the other direction. Reading over the early sections was never a whole lot of fun. But yeah, it was kind of that sense of like, I'm going on this adventure and I'm making choices and I have my character and different powers, but I could die. And there's a lot of that built into the Lord of the Rings game, not kind of, it was a combination of that experience, but on the other side of it was that sense of playing a card game where I built a deck and having kind of this insidious opponent that's trying to counter my moves and keep me from reaching my objectives was combining those two hobbies of mine into a single experience.
Now, I swear I'll tie this to Thrones very, very quickly, but it is my little aside. What really surprises me there is that in those two, I played the same games then, obviously, as you did and read through those books.
Okay. Yep.
But those involved a tremendous amount of text. And in Lord of the Rings, you're able to craft the narrative with mechanics and extremely few lines of text. There are maybe six, maybe five paragraphs of story.
Yep. There's a few things going on there. One is I do have a writing background, and one thing that kind of gets beaten into your head when you're in school is this concept of less is more. So you're always trying to cut and be efficient and imply more than you're actually putting on the page. And I think that the game taps into a lot of that. The other thing is that I think that this has kind of been something else that's kind of guided a lot of my approach to game design, is that I think a lot of games just naturally have a narrative element to them, in that even if it's not actively the game components don't have a story written out on them, people do interpret games as stories. Anybody who's ever been to a large Game of Thrones tournament or any card game tournament will know just how common somebody coming up to them after a game and wanting to tell them how their game went. And it does have this like progression of the build up, and it comes to this critical moment, and then there's this big conflict, and the conflict resolves, and usually at that point somebody wins or loses. And the game does follow kind of a very traditional narrative arc, and you see this in other places too. If you're watching a sporting event, they'll even put up like little graphics of key storylines or stories of the game, and it'll give you like the three things to watch, or the key matchups are like the protagonist. Whatever, the antagonist, yeah. And there's a lot of times where sports narratives are framed with the good guys against the bad guys, or the team everybody loves and the team everybody hates, your heroes and villains. There's a lot of different tie-ins between the way we play and observe games, and also the way we observe fiction.
I taught Thrones today, and I actually described the setup as starting the story in medias res.
Oh, yep. That was actually something that was part of the vision pitch for 2.0, when we were trying to think about what is it that people love about first edition and that we have to have in second edition, and set up described in those very terms, like the game starts in media res, is part of the original vision document.
So Nate, you talked about your hobbies, you know, saying that you like these books and stuff, but I know one of your hobbies, and this is a similar hobby of for myself, and that's you play poker, right?
Yep. I play poker quite a bit. Right now I'm playing about 5 or 6 nights a week, so.
Oh, all right.
It's actually been a good week. Running well right now.
So that's great. But the reason I'm actually wanted to talk about poker is because when I play Game of Thrones, I see some things now in the new edition that I guess I reminisce on poker, because I used to play a lot, like, you know, 6 to 7 hours a day, 7 days a week or something before kids.
Oh, wow.
So so I play way less now, you know.
People are both crazy.
But I noticed that when I'm playing AGOT, especially with the new fact that you have to pay gold for the events, I see this, like, part of bluffing is kind of there, where, you know, I fake to have an event. But then I also see the gamble that I see in poker. You know, sometimes you're in the pot and you realize you have so little chips left, you're just going to have to push in the small remaining amount and hope that, you know, the turn in the river bring the cards you want. Yep. And I look at cards like the Tickler, and again, I think of poker. So does these other hobbies like poker influence your design, do you think? Or did you consciously do any of that in the game, or is it just me being crazy?
I think so. There's definitely a gambling element that's built into some of the Lannister design of it. It's probably influenced by poker, and also I'm a big fan of the daily fantasy sports, and I think that's a place where you kind of also get that similar type of playing with odds and uncertainty and kind of a range of potential outcomes that an opponent, and there's definitely some of that built into Lannister, and trying to tap into that same kind of psychology of taking risks to get rewards is part of their design. I think that the plot deck has always kind of reminded me a little bit of poker too, just in the sense of occasionally these situations emerge where you're trying to outlevel an opponent, where it's kind of like, he knows I have this plot and I know that he knows it. So should I play it? Because I know he's going to know that I know he knows it. You kind of get into these wars of who knows what and who's going to be one step ahead of the opponent. And anytime you have like some of the common one, the naval blockade plot and when people are going to play the plots that it can hit or not, that's one of those moments. Once Valor comes out, there will be.
Wait, did you just say once Valor comes out?
Yeah, so I promised that Valor's been coming out. People have known this since the game was announced. It's just a matter of when. So
okay, all right. I didn't know it was confirmed to that extent. I knew that it had been mentioned as a core element in Thrones. I didn't know that it was actually once it comes out.
Well, if I say something's going to happen, there's a good chance it's going to happen. So we'll leave it there for now.
I love those situations. Nate had one the other day where, you know, he had one character remaining on the board and I had two. One was a Chud, one was an Coster. And I said to myself, do I not actually march here? Because it's so obvious that I'm going to march, he's going to march, and then kill both my characters. And I'm sitting there and I'm dithering. And then finally I'm like, no, I have to. What if he doesn't have it in his plot deck? And sure enough, you know, double marched.
Yep.
And, I like that.
Yeah, I think there are other similarities between the two games, but one place where it plays out a lot, it's not as obvious, but I think the metagame is really the place where players kind of have to make a decision between playing exploitively or playing optimally, and different players will have different theories on what's more valuable here. So basic rundown describing it, I guess, in poker terms, playing exploitively, you're making decisions that they're designed to take advantage of mistakes that your opponents are going to make, to take advantage of, you know, the way that your opponent is going to be playing, and you can exploit that because of the knowledge that you have. The downside of playing exploitively is that it opens you up to being counter-exploited by somebody who either lucks into playing in a way that kind of can take advantage of what you're doing, or because they know you're doing this, you're playing to exploit one weakness and you've opened yourself up to somebody else who can then exploit.
We always say it doesn't work on bad players. They don't know better.
Yeah, that's also the problem, is like you have to target well when you play exploitively. Playing optimally, on the other hand, it could lower your rate of return against those bad players, but it also protects you from somebody exploiting you. And one other thing about the notion of playing optimally that's kind of, it's really interesting to me, both in poker and kind of thinking about CCG metagames. If everybody plays optimally at a given time, nobody has an edge because they're all doing exactly the same thing. And then it's basically down to how the cards turn. If you're playing optimally, you're playing the optimal deck and you're not making any mistakes. So at that point, if everybody is playing optimally, there is no edge in the game, and it's basically who draws the best cards. So I think in all games, there's an interesting tension between at least games with some element of hidden information and not having 100% certainty over what strategy your opponent is choosing. There's a tension between taking an exploitive approach and taking an optimal approach, and different players select different places along the spectrum, and that's where a game really gets interesting and the metagame starts to emerge.
Well, I think maybe we can tie this back to some of the projects and people you've worked with. We left off with Lord of the Rings. If my chronology is right, I think the next game you would have worked on would have been Netrunner?
So Netrunner was the one LCG we've done that I didn't work on actively. Like, I was involved a little bit with playtesting, but that was mostly Lucas Litzinger was the lead on that game, and he did a fantastic job with it. It's definitely one of our most popular games. But yeah, it is the one LCG that I'm the least familiar with. So
then you would have been working on Star Wars at the time.
Yes, I was working on Star Wars. I did go through a couple different versions. We ended up doing a game that kind of took a little bit of a risk with the deck building, and that it's deck building in Star Wars is not card by card. You build with these objective sets where you select 10 objectives, and each objective comes with 5 other cards that enter your deck kind of as a unit. And it was kind of geared towards a different audience, one who might not be as into deck building as people who want to build card by card. It was to ease that side of the approach. And it was a very interesting game to design for, because you're not evaluating the impact and power level and balance of cards in a vacuum. It's how does this group of cards compare to this other group of cards? As far as things, I guess, that we took away from Star Wars and that I carried forward, it was the first generation of the timing system that you see in Thrones 2.0, which was kind of our continued attempts to solve the moribund problems and of Thrones 1.0. So it was the first time that we saw reactions and interrupts as kind of the two sides of the before a triggering condition and after a triggering condition happens. And this was all to solve the problem of how does a card interact with the game state as it leaves play.
Which wasn't a problem at all in Netrunner because there's so little interaction between the two players at any given time.
Yep, yeah, Netrunner doesn't have a whole lot of, like, I'm going to do this thing. Oh, wait, I'm going to jump in and do this first, or in response to what you just did, I'm going to do that. Netrunner is very much kind of on one side of the table or the other, you taking their turn without the whole back and forth and action windows and timing priority things that we get into in the more instant-based games. But yeah, that was kind of the first step in that. We did learn a lot of stuff in putting the Star Wars timing system together, and you saw it evolve into the Conquest timing. I do hear a vacuum in the distance, so if I start to if I become hard to hear, just let me know.
For listeners in general, this is now a running theme. The last time you did a podcast with Cardboard of the Rings, I think we got this fabled vacuum cleaner. Maybe they're just they really like appearing on podcasts?
Apparently, yeah.
We should ask them on. They should at least get a word in.
So yeah, Conquest was then. It was a further development of the Star Wars timing. I guess the other thing that I really kind of started getting back to with Conquest, thinking back to the Cthulhu core set and how much people liked all the different factions and the different combinations out of the box. And I think Conquest was one of the big successes of that game, was being able to get the seven factions in the box. And we set up a pretty interesting mixing within the constraints of the 40K universe. Basically, we set up a wheel where each faction had two allied factions, the left and right of them. And if you went around the wheel, that told you who each faction could ally with. And there was, Thrones players would recognize it as the loyalty system, as far as, like, there were some cards in each faction that could only be used if that was your primary faction, and some cards that you could splash into either of the adjacent factions. So that system, I think, worked really well in Conquest, and we expanded it and also made it even kind of more free, because Game of Thrones, and you can find situations where basically anybody could conceivably in some way, shape, or form be helping somebody else, or at least pretending to help somebody else in the series. It's just a hugely multifaceted world where every faction has, even among themselves, there's internal conflicts and people who are trying to backstab one another, and just a lot of different connections and conflicts and rivalries and alliances form up. So we opened it completely up and said anybody can ally with anybody else at any given time, but you're constrained by this banner mechanic just to keep the pool from being like a free for all where everybody just cherries the best cards.
I never really thought of it as the potential for being backstabbed. Yeah, that moment where your banner of the rose, that might be the moment right before you suddenly become Tyrell banner of whatever you were before.
Yep. One of the editors, Patrick Brennan, I should mention him because he's hugely helpful. Not that you're not, Alex, but I do want to mention Patrick because he was involved in I met him. He was a player of Lord of the Rings, and he would send in questions through the rules links, and I just noticed how kind of insightful and also accurate a lot of his questions and interpretations were. So I started a correspondence with him and worked with him in some playtesting for Star Wars, and eventually started using him as an editor. And he was the editor on Conquest, and he really helped take what we had with the Star Wars system and bring it forward to Conquest. And then he was also one of the three editors that we used on Game of Thrones, which was yourself, Patrick, and Kevin Thompson, also known as K-Tom, the rules guru. And it was to kind of get these three distinct but also very insightful perspectives. And I think it was the work of all three of you that really got the Thrones rule set to a place where it has been really well received. And just a very useful tool in answering the inevitable questions that come up. And I can't say enough about the work that all three of you did on editing this game and taking systems that were in development from Star Wars to Conquest and kind of really bringing them together for the Thrones game. So thank you.
I will say I think that Conquest was about 90% of the way there for Thrones. I mean, the biggest difference from Thrones to Conquest was the addition of saves, which needed their own timing step.
Yep.
Otherwise, the timing is very, very similar.
It is similar. There are places where we definitely identified things that we weren't quite happy with, or we kind of felt weren't explained correctly for Conquest, and were able to just slightly streamline the editing or make it more clear or more accurate for Thrones. So, I do feel that Conquest was close, and Thrones kind of took the next step. Not to say that Thrones is perfect. Like, I always think there's room for improvement, but I definitely, as I look back at Star Wars to Conquest of Thrones, I do see kind of each set getting better and more complete. So
I have to agree. I think the core set is extremely interesting, and people are still, you know, all doing air quotes here, solving the different decks. At first, everyone was complaining, no Baratheon fealty, and then next we heard, oh, it's, you know, Targaryen fealty, and then now it's Lannister to Tyrell, and it just shows the depth that's in that box and how much there is to still learn about that first box. And I think that's great. Now, when you're designing, like, how do you do that? I think the question. Yeah.
Are you prescient or are you lucky?
I don't think it's either. There might be a little bit of both, but I really think that it's a combination of experience with the game. It still is at its core that the same game that I've either been playing or working on for probably about 13 or 14 years. It's also for Thrones 2.0. I worked with more playtesters than I had ever worked with on a project before. And while that in and of itself was an interesting kind of time management and just information management problem to solve, it was also extremely valuable for what it was able to add to the product. We got solid feedback on every combination of faction and every card, and we were even able to break that playtest group down, and we had one group testing for competitive joust. I had one group testing for melee. I had one group testing for just the out-of-the-box, playing out of a single core set experience, and then I had one group that was kind of trying to test it in a variety of modes and looking at the big picture and how things shifted from one mode or format to the other. So it was the number of people and also the quality of people. Most of the playtesters were recruited at Worlds, so these were already players who were kind of at the upper echelon of gamers who were playing first edition. And we did bring in some new people who had never played first edition to get that fresh perspective as well. And it was just quality people, numbers of people. We had a solid development period. Nothing was overly rushed. So it was just a lot of different things came together.
But even then, I think a lot of players who were testers, their names appear in the rule book and you can identify them. And even those players are surprised at the decks that are coming out and the evolution of the meta, and, you know, that Sam Bratz managed to win with Martell at the Worlds Tournament, and that Night's Watch with that wall actually works, which I admit, on the cast, we reviewed it and we thought it would never work. Was it because you got feedback that said it did work, or was that because you said, no, they're wrong about this, they'll see?
It was definitely like we had people. By the end of the session, there were people who were champions of pretty much every faction in that box, telling me, yes, this isn't a good place, and people that I trusted as well. So I was pretty confident that there were options and that it would be an interesting set to come out. Definitely, I think it has surprised me as well, because there's definitely kind of been these periods where it seemed like, oh, it's just Barra fealty all the time, or it's Targ burn. There was a very early, there was kind of a Greyjoy stealth is impossible to deal with period. And the game does, every time it goes into one of these ruts, there's kind of like this hope of like, I hope somebody finds it and finds the way out. But I'm glad that it has kind of continue to find ways to renew itself. And now that the card pool is starting to expand, I think that that's only going to increase and pick up as more and more cards are added to the environment.
It may be a little early to say, but you've mentioned all these things that you've learned about from all these other LCGs and these people that you've worked with. What are some of the lessons you've learned from the Thrones core set that are going forward, not necessarily into other games, because, you know, this was the only game that mattered, but what lessons came out of that core?
Probably the biggest one, I did bite off more than I could chew with the number of playtesting. I wouldn't want quite so many. Like, I did like having a wide variety of people, but I would probably scale that back a little bit more. That was the big one. It was a little bit, in a way, it added extra pressure the way that we announced the Thrones core. Basically, we announced it at Worlds of 2014, saying that it would come out at Gen Con, and that really kind of put a loaded gun to our heads in a way where it's like, this is the deadline that we set, and now we are absolutely locked in. So it felt like there was, well, we did have a fair amount of time. It also kind of moving forward made me feel like there's no wiggle room. As far as the actual composition, I'd probably say at this point it's a little early to tell. I'm still kind of observing the reception. It's really only in hindsight that a lot of these lessons that I was able to kind of talk about with some of these other games really, really emerge, and I'd probably have to think about it a little bit more as far as what I'm going to take forward in this core set and apply to other products.
What I was going to say is that I've had the good fortune of being able to work with you both on this and some other things. We've had arguments about the placement of a single period relative to some parentheses in a 20 email chain. We've had discussions where you mentioned shotgun wielding motorbike riding nuns. None of this is an exaggeration. I've had a great time being able to work with you on that. And I wonder a couple of things that I know that we have discussed in the past, but I'm wondering whether you'd care to share those with our listeners. One is one that keeps coming up, and it's one where I think you convinced me, or it may have been Kevin, K-Tom, who convinced me, and this is the idea of intuitive rules.
Okay.
And by that I mean a lot of people will take a card and then they'll go, oh, this card is unintuitive,
mm-hmm.
and it should have been written intuitively. And a lot of changes in the second edition were made to presumably make things a little more intuitive. Everyone was playing stealth as mm-hmm. something that happened when you declared attackers, so it was moved up. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on anticipating that, on building something because you think it will be intuitive rather than
sure.
because it turns out that's how people were playing it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's intuitive is actually a really interesting word in game evaluation and when people are talking about games. One thing that kind of you learn both when talking to other game designers and also when talking to playtesters is when people start to throw the word intuitive around either to make a point or to justify something, it's very often to me it can kind of come across as being a warning sign that they're actually talking about something that while it makes sense to them might to a lot of people be counterintuitive. I think the best way to find out if something is or is not intuitive is not to ask people about it, because if you ask them about something, they're going to have to consciously think about it. And at the point you're consciously thinking about something, it's no longer intuitive. And it's almost better to give them cards, sit them down, and let them play. And maybe you even ask them about something else, but you are watching and observing how they handle the thing that you're trying to figure out whether or not it's intuitive. And sometimes it's as easy as you create a card ability and you just put it out and see how people interpret it. And there's kind of some people believe that every time we write a card ability, we kind of have a sense of how people are going to interpret it. A lot of times I'll create a card for playtesting, put it out there, and see what they make of it. And sometimes they might interpret it the way that I thought they would. Sometimes they might interpret it in a completely different way. But as it turns out, it's like, in hindsight, it's like, yes, they are interpreting that correctly, and I need to word it like this to get it to do what I want to do.
One thing that we haven't actually touched on, you mentioned it briefly for the CCGs, is draft formats. Now, I don't know how heavily involved you've been in those, but we've certainly seen them show up for Thrones First Edition, for Netrunner. Not asking you to comment on whether they'll be coming for Thrones Second or Conquest or Star Wars or any of those, but it seems like those are also one of those adaptations of a CCG thing going forward, and I wonder how you approach those differently, how you build them from the existing pool, and how some of those lessons might be applied to Thrones, if that ever became relevant.
So yeah, draft format, it was kind of, we have a couple draft formats for Game of Thrones First Edition, and we have some Netrunner draft pools, but it was always, a lot of players who played both CCGs and LCGs love the LCG format, but one thing that we're always hearing from players is how much they miss the draft format when they convert to LCG. It's kind of, for a lot of people, it was the one thing that they felt the format couldn't do as well as a CCG. So we invented the draft format to basically to remedy that situation and give people who enjoy the one of the LCG games the chance to experience that game in a way that is similar to their CCG draft experience. As far as building a pool, this is kind of in a way where I go back to my early days of working on Game of Thrones and Call of Cthulhu CCGs and thinking about cards in terms of rarity again, both in terms of some cards are rare because they're bomb cards and they're chase cards and everybody's going to want them for their power level, and some are rare more just for the uniqueness or splashiness factor of their effect. Like, they're not, common cards are simple and don't add a lot of complexity to the game. Rarer cards are your more complex or kind of wackier cards that could swing a game or just kind of turn a situation upside down or really just complicate the game state in a way that's going to add a lot of thinking. And if you have too many cards that add too much thinking to a game state, then it's just going to create a muddled mess. So you want to take those more complex cards and put them in the rare slot so that in any given game you don't see a lot of them all at once, and your common cards are your more vanilla or French vanilla cards with just a keyword type effects. Those fall into the commons, and then your uncommons are kind of like your faction defining cards that people are going to be fighting over the most in the drafting. So I design around those three rarity levels for draft pool, and it's kind of a matter of going through the card pools and finding relevant themes for each faction and different ideas that they could pull their decks around, and then also assigning cards to those three rarity levels. Another important consideration for draft is ways to get people fighting over cards. So key neutral cards, plot cards, agendas. In first edition, we had this mechanic of multi-faction cards that could belong to more than one faction, and kind of, for example, Bran of Tarth, you could play either as a Baratheon character or a Stark character. Those type of cards that more than one person at the table, even if they're the only one drafting that house, there's going to be other people drafting other houses who want that card. Those are crucial to making a draft format exciting, I think. And yeah, draft format, it originated kind of to meet a demand for the LCG, so I guess the best piece of advice, if there's people out there who would hope to see a draft for second edition, would be just to let us know, either if you see us at conventions or on message boards, just let us know that, yeah, you'd like to see a draft. And if there's enough demand, then you see what we can do about it.
I will say that I've had, with the recent announcement of the Netrunner Champion decks, which have the new templating, the alternate templating, but the original art, several people have commented to me that that would be the ideal way to also motivate people to play, to buy draft packs, because there'd be some of these alternate art versions of the cards without having to commission a whole new art budget for the entire cycle. And that would also create some additional pull. So people, their first thoughts in seeing that were draft. So I certainly think there's demand there, but I'll make sure they all pester you. You've unleashed a storm.
Yeah, that's it. It's never any flood of emails coming.
Maybe have them pester Danny instead of me. That would be the better way to go.
All right. This sounds like the perfect kind of delegation. So as we wrap up, the obvious sort of question is, we have Game of Thrones 2nd Edition. It works very well. We're very excited about it. You've got this rule set, this tool set, and you're still involved in the creative process. Or even within the first cycle, the cards that we haven't seen yet. Yep. What are you really excited about with this tool set that you can do with second edition that maybe you couldn't do in first, or the pool was too big to do, or it didn't have rotation? You know, some of those constraints have changed, and I'm wondering what parts of that excite you.
There's a lot of things. I guess one of the foundational elements that I'm most excited about being able to explore in different ways and move forward with is the faction mixing and the loyalty. Like, the banners as they currently stand have only scratched the surface of the different things we can do as far as letting people build different decks across multiple factions, and haven't started to actively explore any of that yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to doing so. I think the reserve mechanic is also a very untapped field. The current meta seems to be very heavily influenced by gold, and what one kind of catchphrase from AGOT 1.0 was this draw equals win topic. So I think that there is a lot of room to explore the idea of a game with kind of a more open-ended draw cap than what we had in first edition and the reserve mechanic. And there's only a few reserve modifiers now, and reserve is kind of a thing that people, it's almost invisible in the game. And it was intentionally showed. Like, we were putting in this new mechanic, and we wanted it to be there almost more as a safety net than something that people actively felt as a constraining measure early on. But I think kind of as we move forward, it's going to be something that more and more gets explored and emphasized as kind of card advantage in the defining sense of, how do I increase my reserve and build up card advantage? Or how do I attack my opponent's reserve and hurt their card advantage? And I think we've only really scratched the surface there as far as what can be done with that area of game space in the Game of Thrones game.
I'm excited just thinking about it. I'm sold.
Then there's also kind of this emerged from just some conversations that I've had with various playtesters, but there is a sense among people who played both games that, like, we've done what we set out to do. Like, we put out a pretty comprehensive vision statement of what we wanted the game to be and what we were bringing forward, and we've crossed the bridge and come across, and we do have kind of the foundation and the starting point of the things we wanted to preserve. And there's a couple of new things, like some of the banners and the reserve value and some rules, like some of the rules changes, like stealth and the higher gold curve. Like, there's some things that are new, but people knew this was coming. But other than these key changes we made from first edition to second edition, we haven't done anything really revolutionary, taking people to a place they haven't expected to go yet. And that's also intentional. Like, when a new game comes out, you want people to get that core experience of the game, and also kind of you want a period of stability for the first few years of a game. But one thing about Game of Thrones, and if you just go to George Martin's writing, is he's never going to be predictable. And I think that there is a time where the game is not going to want to be predictable too. So I'm looking forward to the first time that I'm able to take the game in a direction that completely makes people's jaws drop. And, like, we never saw that coming. So I'm looking forward to that, to those type of moments in the slightly more distant future as well.
I got a tip of the week for us that is near and dear to my heart, John.
Uh-oh. Let's hear it.
This happened, so last Thursday, I was playing a couple of Octagon games, and about at the same time, James Walmsley posted an article deconstructing his terrible deck, and how he had lost at a tournament, and things had happened badly, and then he went back and looked at it and saw what he could improve. Mm-hmm. And so these two things sort of came together to really remind me that blaming luck for your losses is terrible. Yes, luck is involved, but luck is not something you can modify, and it's not a learning experience. And even in a game where you got unlucky, there is a lesson to be learned from your loss. And if you're just going to dismiss it on, as one of my opponents did, you know, I didn't see Nymeria, when honestly Nymeria would have changed nothing, then you haven't learned anything about the six or seven other mistakes that you made in that game. And you did make them, and I made them too. I feel like you're throwing away everything that you could have gotten from that game if you're going to walk out and say, I lost because of luck. That should be the very last thing you look at. You go, you know, this is what I could have done to prolong the game. This is where the game turned. This moment here was the crucial moment. And, you know, okay, maybe you maximize the odds in your favor, and you have that building season and the summons to thin your deck, and you really wanted to find that character, but luck was not the reason you consistently lose.
This is true. Especially that consistent part. They have the same concept in poker where you shouldn't be blaming luck. You're always saying that, oh, bad players beat me because they all get lucky. If all the bad players are beating you, it's not just luck.
The thing is, yeah, you have poor setups and you have all of these other things. But tossing away a game just because you got a poor setup is you're losing a whole bunch of the learning experience that you can get. And
you can't do that in a tournament. You got to play it out and try to win that thing. You know, you can't take these losses.
So I think it's not to say that there isn't luck in this game or that there isn't luck in poker, but it's that if you want to continue improving as a player, you shouldn't walk away from that game thinking, ah, damn, I was really unlucky. You should walk away from that game thinking about five or six other things. Hey, closing comments, John. We're running way over.
Okay, I'll do a quick self-promotion for my wife. She's doing coin and power counter bags for Game of Thrones.
And where can one find coin and power the thing you just said?
They could go see her Facebook page, which is Terra at Home. She's got them posted there. She's got a Martell up and a Targaryen. And by the time this airs, she'll probably have a Rose, a Greyjoy, and a Stark up too.
I think you posted a picture of them on CardGameDB as well, so I'll include a link to that. And what are you playing at this weekend's SC then, John?
So next Sunday, I think I'm going to play Greyjoy Fealty. I haven't played a single game with it yet, but I wanted to play that. I built it, and I bugged you a little bit about it earlier today. So I guess I'll play that. And I don't want to play Lannister because I thought that was the flavor of the week.
And now Greyjoy is. Ah.
But I can change to Lannister to Greyjoy or Lannister to Martell.
You were Greyjoy before they were cool.
Oh, silly. Every time I think the whole meta shifts with the same thoughts. They're like, ooh, something new. Let's all try this. So.
All right. I have one more tiny piece of information as a closing comment, a teaser. Today's episode, hope you liked it. Hope you enjoyed having Nate French on. The day we recorded that, we recorded something else with him.
Oh, and it's good. Oh, it's so good, Alex.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Somewhere along that track that you feel we missed on, or
we were talking about my hobbies at one point. Basically, another thing that I really enjoy doing is just reading, and I'm currently reading Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn trilogy. I'm almost done with book two. I'm really enjoying it, and I think a lot of people, if they're into George Martin, they would also really enjoy checking this series out if they haven't already done so. So I just wanted to throw that recommendation out there.
Alex Sanderson. I mean,
I will warn you that book three is
bad.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Arthur series, actually, the one in the Wild West is fun, though.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Sanderson is a compulsive writer, and he comes up with a lot of good ideas, but sometimes I feel like his better work was some of the young adult stuff he's done was actually better suited to his writing pace.
Like Steelheart.
Steelheart, for instance, is a very good example. I think Steelheart was good, the Reckoners series. I feel like Mistborn, the first one, was really good. The second one was a little more ponderous. The ending was really good, so you've got something to look forward to.
Right.
And the third one was a little tedious. And then I sort of feel the same with his Words of Radiance series, or whatever it's called, Knights Radiant.
Gotcha. Where, yeah, I haven't read that one. I've read both standalone. Well, I guess they're not standalone anymore, but I really enjoyed Elantris. And
Elantris was quite good. I found the ending disappointing, but everything up to there was actually really, really good.
Sure.
Love the Knights Radiant's first book.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fantastic. It was epic. It was slow, though.
Well, the chapters with the female character were
super slow.
Very, very slow.
Yeah.
And then in the second book, they were faster but more annoying.
That's the one that only has the two books out right now.
Currently, yes.
Yeah, so that's the one I'm So my whole experience with Song of Ice and Fire is that I've kind of made a vow that I don't want to start any more long series until they are complete. Like, Sanderson's probably not really that risky because he kind of grinds out the books.
Yeah, he churns out about six books a year.
Yeah, I don't want to get another situation where I'm partway through a series and waiting for the next one to come out. Just, I like finishing something before I start the next thing, so.
Tournament-wise, there's also a brand new tournament software. Oh dear, I think we can probably hear Lena howling.
Yes. I can. She has good lungs.
She's very irritated right now. So, tournament-wise, there's also a new come on.
She doesn't want you to talk about the tournament software.
She doesn't want me to talk about the tournament software. All right. Well, she probably doesn't want me to talk about Thrones War or UK Nationals either, so we'll give it a few minutes.
Or the other SCs that happened this weekend. Mm-hmm.